Hachette Audio presents Invisible, written by James Patterson and David Ellis. Read by January Lavoie and Kevin T. Collins.
1. This time, I know it. I know it with a certainty that chokes my throat with panic, that grips and twists my heart until it's ripped from its mooring. This time, I'm too late. This time, it's too hot. This time, it's too bright. There's too much smoke. The house alarm is screaming out. Not the early warning beep, but the piercing, "You're totally screwed if you don't move now," squeal. I don't know how long it's been going off, but it's too late for me now. The searing oven blast heat within the four corners of my bedroom. The putrid black smoke that singes my nostril hairs and pollutes my lungs. The orange flames rippling across the ceiling above me, dancing around my bed almost in rhythm, a taunting staccato popping and crackling, like it's not a fire but a collection of flames working together. Collectively, they want me to know as they bob up and down and spit and cackle, as they slowly advance. This time, it's too late, Emmy. The window. Still a chance to jump off the bed to the left and run for the window, the only part of the bedroom still available. The enemy is cornering me, daring me. Go ahead, Emmy. Go for the window, Emmy. This is my last chance, and I know, but don't want to think about what happens if I fail. That I have to start preparing myself for the pain. It will just hurt for a few minutes. It will be teeth-gnashing, gut-twisting agony, but then the heat will shrivel off my nerve endings and I'll feel nothing. Or better yet, I'll pass out from carbon monoxide poisoning. Nothing to lose. No time to waste. The flames hit my flannel comforter as my legs kick over to the floor, as I bounce up off the mattress and race the 1, 2, 3, 4 steps to the window. A girlish, panicky squeal escapes my throat, like when Daddy and I used to play chase in the backyard and he was closing in. I lower my shoulder and lunge against the window, a window that was specifically built to not shatter, and ringing out over the alarm's squeal and the lapping of the flames is a hideous roar, a hungry growl, as I bounce off the window and fall backward into the raging heat. I tell myself, "Breathe, Emmy. Suck in the toxic pollution. Don't let the flames kill you. Breathe. Breathe. Take a breath. Damn," I say to nobody in my dark, fire-free room. My eyes sting from sweat, and I wipe them with my t-shirt. I know better than to move right away. I remain still until my pulse returns to human levels, until my breathing evens out. I look over at the clock radio, where red fluorescent square numbers tell me it's 2:30. Dreams suck. You think you've conquered something. You work on it over and over and tell yourself you're getting better. You will yourself to get better. You congratulate yourself on getting better. And then you close your eyes at night. You drift off into another world, and suddenly your own brain is tapping you on the shoulder and saying, "Guess what? You're not better." I let out one conclusive exhale and reach for my bedroom light. When I turn it on, the fire is everywhere. It's my wallpaper now. The various photographs and case summaries and inspector's reports adorning the walls of my bedroom. Fires involving deaths in cities throughout the United States. Hawthorne, Florida. Skokie, Illinois. Cedar Rapids, Iowa. Plano, Texas. Piedmont, California. And of course, Peoria, Arizona. 53 of them in all. I move along the wall and quickly review each one. Then I head to my computer and start opening emails. 53 that I know of. There are undoubtedly more. This guy isn't going to stop. 2. I'm here for the dick. That's not what I actually say, but that's what I mean. Emmy Dockery for Mr. Dickinson, please. The woman parked at a wedge of a desk outside Dickinson's office is someone I've never met. Her nameplate says Lydia, and she looks like a Lydia. Cropped brown hair and black horn-rimmed glasses and a prim silk blouse.
She probably writes sonnets in her spare time. She probably has 3 cats and likes Indian food, only she would call it cuisine. I shouldn't be so catty, but it annoys me that there's someone new, that something has changed since I left, so I feel like a stranger in an office where I faithfully labored for almost 9 years.
Did you have an appointment with the director, Ms. Dockery?
Lydia looks up at me with a satisfied smirk. She knows I don't have an appointment. She knows because they called up from the lobby to see if I was authorized to enter. She's just reminding me that I've only gotten this far as some kind of courtesy. The director? I ask with faux confusion. You mean the executive assistant director for the Criminal Cyber Response and Services Branch? Okay, I can be a bitch, but she started it. I wait Lydia out because I wouldn't be standing here if the dick hadn't agreed to see me. He makes me wait, which is so like him. But 20 minutes later, I'm in the office of the dick. Dark wood walls and trophy photographs on the walls, diplomas, ego stuff. The dick has a tremendous and entirely undeserved opinion of himself. Julius Dickinson. He of the ever-present tan and comb-over, the extra 10 pounds, the smarmy smile, gestures to a seat for me. Emmy, he says, thick with false pity in his voice, but his eyes bright. Already he's trying to get a rise out of me. You haven't returned any of my emails, I say, taking a seat. That's right, I haven't, he says, making no attempt to justify the stiff arm he's given me. He doesn't have to. He's the boss. I'm just an employee. Hell, I'm not even that at the moment. I'm an employee on unpaid leave whose career is hanging by a string, whose career could be destroyed by the man sitting across from me. Have you at least read them? I ask. Dickinson removes a silk cloth from his drawer and cleans his eyeglasses.
I got far enough to see that you're talking about a series of fires, he says. Fires that you think are the work of a criminal genius who has managed to make them appear unrelated.
Basically, yes.
What I did read in its entirety, he adds with a sour note, was a recent article from the Peoria Times, the local newspaper in a small Arizona town.
He lifts up a printout of the article and reads from it.
8 months after her sister's death in a house fire, Emmy Dockery is still on a crusade to convince the Peoria Police Department that Marta Dockery's death was not an accident, but murder. Oh, and this part. Dr. Martin Lazerby, a deputy medical examiner with the Maricopa County Medical Examiner's Office, insists that all forensic evidence points to death by an accidental fire. And this is my favorite, a quote from their police chief. She works for the FBI, he said. If she's so sure it's murder, why doesn't she get her own agency to investigate it?
I don't respond. The article was crap. They took the police's side and didn't even give a fair airing of my evidence.
It makes me wonder about you, Emmy.
He puts his hands together and collects his thoughts, like he's about to lecture a child.
Have you been getting therapy, Emmy? You badly need help. We'd love to have you return, of course, but only after we've seen some progress in your treatment.
He can hardly suppress a smile as he says this. He and I have history. He was the one who had me brought up on disciplinary charges for inappropriate conduct that got me suspended. I'm sorry, in bureaucratic legal lingo, placed on unpaid administrative leave. I've still got 7 weeks before I return, and even then, it will be a 60-day probationary period. If I hadn't had a recent death in the family, I probably would have been canned. He knows the real reason why I was brought up on charges. We both do. So he's taunting me here. I can't let him get under my skin. That's what he wants. He wants me to blow up so he can tell the brass that I'm not ready to return. Somebody's running around the country killing people, I say. That should concern you whether I'm in therapy or not. His eyes narrow. He doesn't have to do anything here. I'm the one who wants something. So this is his idea of torture, sitting there tight-lipped and stubborn.
Concentrate on your rehabilitation, Emmy. Leave the law enforcement to us.
He keeps repeating my name. I'd rather he spit on me and called me names, and he knows that. This is the passive-aggressive version of waterboarding. I wasn't sure he'd see me today, unannounced. Now I realize he probably couldn't wait to see me, to shut me down, to laugh directly in my face. He and I have a history, like I said. Here's the short version. He's a pig. This isn't about me, I insist. It's about a guy who... Are you feeling angry right now, Emmy? Do you feel like you're in control of your emotions? He looks me over with mock concern.
Because your face is getting red. Your hands are balled up in fists. I'm concerned you still can't contain your emotions. We have counselors on staff, Emmy, if you need someone to talk to.
He sounds like a late-night commercial for chemical dependency. We have counselors waiting to talk to you. Call now. There's no point in proceeding further, I realize. It was dumb of me to come, dumb of me to expect he'd listen to me in person. I was screwed before I got here. I get up and turn to leave.
Good luck with your therapy, he calls out. We're all rooting for you.
I stop at the door and look back at him. This man is killing people all over the country, I say, one hand on his office door. And it's not that we're chasing him and can't catch him. It's that we don't even know there's someone to catch. It's like he doesn't even exist to us. Nothing from the dick but his cupped hand. A tiny wave goodbye. I slam the door behind me. 3. I wait until I leave the building before I blow off any steam. I won't give Dickinson the satisfaction of seeing me angry, and I won't give him fodder to use against me when I try to return to my job in 7 weeks. The truth is, I probably already have. He can point to my emails, and however he chooses to paint the conversation we just had as proof that I'm obsessive, and also committing the greatest sin of a research analyst, acting like an agent, forgetting my place in the hierarchy. When I settle into the return drive on I-95, I give my steering wheel a couple of good hard smacks, which doesn't make me feel any better and, if I'm not careful, could leave me with broken fingers. Asshole! I yell. That makes me feel better. The only thing I might hurt is my vocal cords. Asshole! Asshole! Dickinson owns me now after the disciplinary hearing. I'll be on probation, and if I make one false step, or if the dick even claims I misstepped, I'm done. Ugh. Watching him smirk at me back there, pretending that I'm in need of therapy. We both know my only disciplinary problem was that I pushed his hand off my knee every time he put it there. I said no to late dinners and even laughed at the idea of a weekend getaway just the two of us. It was the laugh, I think, that finally did it. By the next morning, he had concocted some story to the upper brass that I was harassing him and becoming more and more aggressive. Add in words like erratic and volatile, words that are easy to say and hard to disprove, and voila, you are a discipline problem. Asshole. But really, Emmy, get a grip. Solve the problem. I have to do something. I can't give up on this. I know these cases are connected, but I'm stuck. I can't go outside the chain of command, and the dick is shutting me down, not on merit, but out of spite. I'm stuck. What can I do? What else can I possibly... Wait. I let my foot off the pedal for no particular reason other than pissing off the SUV driver behind me. He is following me a little close. While I think it over. No. No. It's the last thing I should do. But, yes, it might be my only way in. So I have to try it. Because if I'm right about this guy, he's getting better and better at killing. And nobody even knows he exists. 4.
Graham Session, recording number 1, August 21st, 2012. Welcome to my world. You can call me Graham, and I'll be your host. You don't know me. My anonymity is a testament to my success. As I'm sitting here talking to you, I'm not famous, but I will be when these recordings are released. Whenever it is that I decide to release them, then I'll be on the front page of every newspaper and magazine around the world. They will write books about me. They will study me at Quantico. Websites will be devoted to me. Movies made. You will never know my real identity. Graham may or may not be my real name, so whatever you know about me will come from these audio files, my oral diary. You will know what I let you know. I may tell you everything, and I may leave some things out. I may tell you the truth, and I may lie to you. A bit about me, to start. I was sufficiently athletic to play high school sports, but not enough to go beyond. I got good grades in school, but not enough for the Ivy League, so it was a state university for me. I absolutely detest onions of any variety, cooked or raw, a vile weed, no matter its iteration. I can speak three languages, though my French borders on the embarrassing at this point. But I can say, no onions, please, or the functional equivalent of that phrase in no less than 11 languages, having recently added Greek and Albanian to my tally. I prefer your basic pop music to classical or adult alternative or heavy metal, but I don't admit that to my friends. I once ran a half marathon in 1 hour and 37 minutes. I don't exercise regularly now, and I never, ever drink light beer. Two of the things I just told you aren't true. But this one is. I've killed a lot of people. More than you'd believe. And you? I don't even know who you are. The person to whom I'm addressing this narrative, a sentient being? Perhaps the spirit of one of my victims? A tiny demon perched on my shoulder, whispering dark thoughts in my ear? An FBI profiler? An enterprising reporter? Or just an ordinary citizen listening to these audio files on the internet someday, hovering over the computer with lascivious fascination, hungry for any morsel, any kernel of information, any insight whatsoever into the mind of a madman. Because, of course, that's what you'll do. You'll try to understand me, diagnose me. It makes you feel comfortable and safe to do that, to assign me to some nice, neat category. You'll ascribe my behavior to a mother who didn't show me love, a traumatic event that redefined me, a mental illness in the DSM-4. But here is what you'll find instead. I could be chatting you up in a neighborhood bar, or trimming the hedges next door, or sitting next to you on a jet from New York to Los Angeles, and you would never even notice me. Oh, in hindsight, sure, you might pick out something about me that seemed off, but in real time, when I'm standing right in front of you, or sharing an armrest or seated across from you, I would make no impression on you. I would be a set of data collected and immediately discarded. I would seem, in a word, normal. And do you know why? No, you don't know why. But I do. It's why I'm so good at what I do. And why nobody will ever catch me. End.
5. 2 years after it opened, The bookstore in downtown Alexandria still looks fresh and new, red brick with wood trim painted powder blue. The name The Bookman is stenciled across the front sidewalk window, which is filled with the latest releases, fiction and nonfiction, but focusing more these days on children's and picture books. I take a breath before I enter the store, debating yet again the wisdom of this decision. But I've hardly slept the last two nights, and I'm out of other ideas. I push through the door to the ding of a cheerful bell, and I see him before he sees me. He is wearing a plaid, short-sleeved shirt untucked, blue jeans, and moccasins. It gives me a start to see him not wearing a suit and tie. It smells like new books and coffee in here. Sedate. Peaceful. He's behind the counter ringing up a customer when he sees me. He does a double take, then remembers to smile at the customer and throws a bookmark into a plastic bag. When the customer's on her way, he comes around. He wipes his hands on his jeans and stops short of me. Hello, books. Figure I might as well start.
Emmy?
Just hearing his voice, deep and commanding but somehow gentle, unleashes so many memories from behind the mental dam I've erected. The gentle part is a tad more so, I notice. Probably because the last time we saw each other, 8 months ago, I was burying my sister. He showed up the morning of the visitation to console me. I'm not even sure how he knew about it. Maybe my mother called him, I never asked. But there he was, never pushing, just fading into the woodwork, making himself available if I needed him. He always had the capacity to surprise me. Thanks for agreeing to see me, I say.
I didn't. You just showed up.
Then thanks for not kicking me out.
I haven't had the chance to kick you out. I still might.
It's the first time I've smiled in weeks. Books looks great. Fit and relaxed, happy. A jerk. Isn't he supposed to be miserable after our breakup? Are you still a coffee snob? I ask. Now he smiles a little, grudgingly. Lots of memories there. Even on a government employee's salary, he always sprang for the good stuff, ordering Italian beans over the internet.
Of course,
he says.
Are you still a neurotic pain in the ass with a big heart?
That's a fair assessment. Books knows me better than anybody. Still, the small talk between us is awkward, forced. I might as well cut to the chase. I need your help, I tell him. 6.
No,
Book says, shaking his head furiously.
No way, Em.
I want you to hear me out on this one, Books.
No thanks.
You've never heard anything like this.
As I said, or think I said out loud, no thank.
This one gets my vote as the most evil prick in the entire history of the world. I'm not exaggerating for effect, Books.
I'm not interested. I'm not,
he repeats, as if trying to convince himself. We're in the warehouse next to his store, surrounded by books stacked on tables or sorted on shelves. I found a small space on one of the tables, where I stacked up 53 case files for his review. It's all right there, I say. Just read it. Books runs a hand through his sandy hair. It's longer these days, bangs hanging over his forehead and curls in the back, now that he's a private citizen. He paces in a circle while he collects his thoughts.
I don't work for the Bureau anymore,
he says. You could come back for this, I answer. They never wanted you to leave.
This is more an ATF assignment anyway.
Then we'll do a joint task force.
This is not my problem, Em.
He swipes at a table and knocks a stack of paperbacks to the floor.
You know how hard this is for me? To have you suddenly show up like this and to ask me for help? This isn't fair.
He jabs a finger at me.
This is not fair.
He's right. It's not fair. But this isn't about fair. Books stands there for about 2 minutes, hands on his hips, shaking his head. Then he looks over at me.
Dickinson shut you down?
Yes, but not on merit. He never even read the files. You know the dick. Books allows for that.
And did you tell him why you care about this?
He asks. It's obvious why I care.
A man is killing—
That's not what I mean, Em, and you know it.
He walks toward me now.
Does Dickinson know that your sister died in a fire of suspicious origin 8 months ago in Peoria, Arizona?
That has nothing to do with this.
Ha!
A mock laugh, hands flying up.
This has nothing to do with it.
It doesn't. Whether my sister was one of the victims or not doesn't change the fact that a serial—
Books doesn't want to hear it. He waves me off. La, 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 I'm not listening.
Emmy, I'm sorry about Marta. You know I am, but—
If you're sorry, then you'll help me.
As soon as I say the words, even I realize I've crossed a line. Books has moved on with his life. He's done being a special agent. He sells books for a living now. I put up my hands. Strike that last comment, I say. I shouldn't have come here, Books. I'm sorry. I walk out the same way I came in, without a word from my former fiancé. 7.
Graham Session, recording number 2, August 22nd, 2012. I love the smell of fresh flowers in the evening. It's such a summer unique smell, isn't it? It makes this whole bedroom feel, what's the word? New. New and fresh. Fresh paint on the walls, pink with lemon accents. That bed is new, too, a queen-size bed with an old-fashioned canopy. Is that like what you had when you were a little girl, Joelle? Was this a congratulatory present from Mom and Dad on the new townhouse, the new start on life? Oh, never mind. I'm afraid Joelle can't talk right now. The rest of this is positively quaint. The antique vanity, probably dusted off and hauled up from the parents' basement. A nice reading chair. Best of all, the makeshift nightstand. Straight out of a college dorm room, two milk crates stacked with a small alarm clock, and that vase of fresh lilies. A girl on a budget, with some taste, but not yet the money to showcase it. A starter townhouse for a girl starting a professional life. I wish I could take a picture of this room and show it to you, because this, right here, is the essence of America. The essence of hope, of starting small but dreaming big things. Joelle Swanson had grand plans. She dreamed of taking her criminal justice degree and becoming a big crime fighter. Maybe first a cop, but someday the FBI, or even the covert world of the CIA. Impressive stuff. Big things. Anyway, I'd like to take a photograph for you, but I don't see how that will work later, how it would fit in with my narrative. I'd be too afraid you'd look at the pictures and ignore my words. I'm sure a psychiatrist would say that I limit these sessions to my oral testimony because I want to control every aspect of it. I only want you to know what I let you know, to see what I let you see. It's true that this mode of communication has its limitations. You can't smell what I smell, that palpable odor pumped out through the glistening sweat on their skin. You can't see that desperate terror, the dilated pupils, quivering lips, the sheet white color their skin turns when they realize that their worst nightmare has come true. You can't hear the sounds of a plaintive cry, a weepy, panicked, breathless plea forced out through a full throat. You simply cannot experience what I'm feeling. So I will do my best to help you. I will do my best to teach you. Oh, look who's waking up. I guess that means I have to bid you
Adieu. I wonder if this is too much, too fast with you. Maybe you need to get to know me better first before I let you see what I do up close like this. Maybe I need to dance cheek to cheek with you first. Wine and dine you, tell you some anecdotes, show you what I find funny and scary, my likes and dislikes. Maybe I should tell you why I do what I do. Why I pick who I pick. Why I'm so damn good at it. I have so many things to tell you. But let's take this slowly. We'll get there. By the time I'm done, you're going to understand me. You're going to find common ground with me. Heck, you may even like me. And some of you will want to be me. And
8. I pop awake, gasping for air, the dancing flames on the ceiling receding to a dark, quiet room. I wipe sweat from my eyes with the comforter and shake away the remnants of the familiar nightmare, only this time with a twist. This time, the person in the bed wasn't me. This time, the person in the bed was prettier than me, smarter than me, braver than me. This time, the person in the bed was Marta. My sister has made the occasional cameo in the dream, basically the same dream as when I'm the one about to be burned alive, only she doesn't scramble for the window like I do. She sucks in her breath and lets the flames race along the comforter until they lick her and swallow her whole. I'm sure I won't be able to go back to sleep. I never can. I've taken to an early bedtime, early for me anyway, 10 o'clock usually, knowing that sometime between 2 and 4 in the morning, I'll be engulfed in flames, then up for the day. So I put on some coffee and boot up my laptop. The breaking news emails come at all hours of the night, so I'll have plenty to keep me busy. I make the mistake of passing a mirror and looking at my reflection. Not a pretty sight. The first signs of gray in my locks, and I'm too stubborn to color my hair, too proud to succumb to modern technology's answer to female aging, which is to change yourself in every way possible, to hide your flaws. I put on minimal makeup and shower most days and brush my hair and figure I've done enough. No wrinkle creams or hair coloring or push-up bras for this gal. I'm supposed to be impressing someone with this attitude, aren't I? So far, no line has formed to congratulate me. You're your own worst enemy, Marta always said to me. You don't need anyone to torment you because you do it to yourself. Marta was, in many ways, the polar opposite of me. Fun-loving when I was brooding. Glamorous when I was granola. Waving pom-poms and cheering on the football team while I was joining the PETA protest of the slaughterhouse outside of town. Partying on Friday nights with the popular crowd while I had my nose in one of the classics or some book on statistics. She was 2 inches shorter than me, had darker and silkier hair, and wore a cup size larger than me. How 2 girls born within the space of 8 minutes could be so different was anyone's guess. Damn, I miss you, girl, I say to nobody in the kitchen. I can't even say that line without an acknowledgement to her. It was what she always said to me at the end of our phone calls. Her patented sign-off when we were across the country from each other during college, or when she went off to grad school in Arizona while I, for some reason nobody could figure out, joined the G, the Federal Bureau of Investigation. I still remember her reaction to the news that I was signing up with the FBI. Her face read stunned, confused, like she'd heard it wrong. A left-wing protester joining the establishment. But her words came out softer. If it makes you happy, it makes me happy. That was the other thing she always harped on with me. Happiness. Just be happy, Em. Are you happy? It's okay to want to be happy. Coffee's done. I carry a mug into the second bedroom and start scrolling through the usual websites and checking email. Nothing I see immediately raises the hair on my neck. A single-family home up in flames in Palo Alto, no casualties. A fire in a subsidized housing complex in Detroit, several believed dead. A chemical plant ablaze outside Dallas. No, no, and no. But this one might be interesting. A fire that happened only hours ago in a place called Lisle, Illinois. A standalone townhouse. A single victim. Her name is Joelle Swanson. 9.
Graham Session, recording number 3, August 23rd, 2012. The day after. Not unlike a hangover, the comedown after an overly indulgent night. I'm lying in bed, talking to you with this handheld digital voice recorder, staring at the photograph of Joelle Swanson I took last night, after we ended things, and which I printed out on my color printer. She was a fighter. I'll give her that. All that blood, all that pain. And yet she still fought for her life at the end. Sometimes, I just don't understand people. I know, I told you I don't take photographs, but I do take one of each victim at the end of the encounter. Can't a fellow keep a souvenir? Anyway, good morning. I try to start each day with the sunrise roundup at 5 a.m. No better source for car crashes, murders, other incidents of ill tidings. Especially on a day like today, the quote-unquote day after. The news is required viewing. Here, I'm pulling up the video clip on the website right now. Here it is. A house fire claimed the life of a woman in suburban Lisle overnight. 23-year-old Joelle Swanson, a recent graduate of Benedictine University, was killed when a fire erupted in her townhouse bedroom in the early hours of Wednesday morning. Authorities say the cause of the blaze was a lit candle that tipped over by her bedside. They do not suspect foul play. Well, coming up next in sports, the NFL season is just around the corner, but a labor dispute will keep the referees... Enough. Click that right off. I wish you could have seen the footage of the ink-black smoke billowing out of the rooftop of Joelle's townhouse. I love that word, billowing. One of those words that really only applies in one context. Does anything else besides smoke ever billow? They also had a sanitized photograph of Joelle that must have come from her recent graduation yearbook, posed and airbrushed. I prefer my photo of her. It has more character, more scars, more life. By the way, I'm aware that it's strategically indefensible to retain photographs of my victims. Yes, I know. If I were caught, this would be a blow-by-blow tour of what I've done, better than a signed confession. What can I say? I need these photographs. I'm willing to be reckless on this one point. If it makes you feel better, I stash my collage between pages 232 and 233 of my mother's old Betty Crocker cookbook, right next to the recipe for ground beef lasagna. Yes, it was a deliberate, if gory, choice. Ooh, you're thinking, his mother. The first mention of his mother occurs during the third session at 3:17. Is there some significance to the time? Is 317 their street address growing up? Was her birthday March 17th? Did she sexually abuse him 3+17 times? Okay, I might as well tell you. My mother made me dress up like Little Bo Peep when I was a child. And it's haunted me ever since. After I killed her with a machete, I vowed to mutilate all beautiful young blonde women with whom I came into contact to rid myself of that horror. But it doesn't make the nightmares go away. Just kidding. I know, I didn't sell that very well. Didn't have my heart in it. Maybe I'll tell you about my mother sometime. Maybe I won't. I need to get ready for work now. Big day planned. I have one more adventure planned, at least, before Labor Day. End.
10. I spend the morning like I've spent every morning the last several months, sitting in my office, also known as my mother's second bedroom, combing through research and data. Because I'm on suspension, I don't have access to NIBRS, the National Incident-Based Reporting System. But NIBRS is useless to me anyway. It only collects information on fires classified as arson. If they're deemed accidental or even suspicious in origin, they never make it to NIBRS. And my guy is making the fires look accidental, which means he's staying totally off the radar. The locals aren't reporting these fires to the feds, and they aren't talking to each other. Which leaves me with the utterly unscientific method of setting up alerts on sites like Google and YouTube, then monitoring websites and message boards devoted to firefighting and arson, and getting breaking news reports from local news websites. There are fires involving the loss of human life every day in this country, intentional or accidental, and whether they are reported to federal law enforcement or not, they at least make the local news in that area. So I'm inundated on a daily basis with news of fires, 99% of which is irrelevant, but all of which I have to review to make sure one of them isn't the needle in the haystack. It's late afternoon now. I've spent hours huddled over this laptop and chasing down leads. I made one inquiry about the fire in Lisle, Illinois, but the cop there hasn't called me back yet. My smartphone buzzes. Speak of the devil. I assume it's the cop, but after a day of solitary confinement, I'd happily chat up a telemarketer selling me life insurance. I set my cell to speakerphone and call out a hello.
Ms. Dockery, it's Lieutenant Adam Ressler, Lisle PD.
Yes, Lieutenant, thanks for the return call.
Ms. Dockery, could you clarify for me your status? Are you with the FBI?
This is my problem. I'm not. It would be bad enough that I'm a research analyst, not a special agent. Some locals will only talk to agents, but I'm not even a research analyst right now. When they look up my authorization code, they always find mine, so they know I am who I say I am. But the problem is that there's no clearance level next to that code. I'm on temporary leave with the Bureau, I answer, working on a special assignment. A lawyer would call that a technically accurate statement. It just so happens that the FBI has nothing to do with this special assignment, which in fact I have assigned to myself. Basically, I'm a girl on suspension who is doing something completely on her own. But I made it sound a little better than that without lying. Usually this works, to a point. I manage to fall on the spectrum somewhere between a random citizen or nosy reporter and an actual law enforcement officer. So I get answers to generally harmless questions, minimally sufficient for my purposes, but not enough to give me the full picture I would prefer.
Well, okay, why don't we see what you need, he says,
meaning he'll answer some questions and not others.
You were calling about Joel Swanson?
That's right, Lieutenant. The fire from 3 nights ago. This is all I know so far. Joel Swanson, age 23, resided at a new townhouse at 2141 Carthage Court in Lisle, Illinois, a suburb roughly 25 miles outside Chicago. She lived alone. She was a recent graduate of Benedictine University and was working in their admissions office. She was single, no kids, not even a boyfriend. She died in the fire overnight in the early hours of August 22nd. No sign of foul play, according to the local fire chief. What was the cause? I asked the lieutenant.
A burning candle, he says. Looks like it was on a desk and fell over onto the carpet. Between the carpet and some newspapers lying around and the polyurethane mattress, the whole bedroom went up real fast. The victim was burnt to toast right there on the bed.
I remain quiet, hoping he'll keep going.
Chief said there was no evidence of an accelerant used. He said it looks like, well, he said, one of those stupid things people do, falling asleep with a lit candle. and with some stray newspapers conveniently lying around.
You're sure the fire originated in the bedroom?
Yeah, fire chief said no question. No question of cause or origin.
What about the candle? I ask.
What about it?
Any theory as to how it fell over?
He doesn't answer.
It probably seems like a minor point to him, but really, how likely is it that a candle sitting on a desk would just fall over? It was indoors, after all. It's not like a harsh wind blew it over.
If you don't mind me asking, says the lieutenant, why does the FBI care about this?
Wish I could answer that, Lieutenant.
You know how it goes. Well, okay then.
Will there be an autopsy?
I don't think so, no.
Why not?
Well, for one thing, I'm not sure there's a body left to autopsy. And the better question is why? The chief says there's no sign of foul play. We don't know of any reason anyone would want to hurt her, and we don't have any evidence that anyone did hurt her.
That's why you perform an autopsy, Lieutenant. To find the evidence. There is a pause in the action. Over the speakerphone, it is dead silence, as if he's hung up. Maybe he did. Cops don't like being told their business by anyone, but especially not by the Phoebes.
I know why you perform an autopsy, Ms. Dockery, but you don't autopsy every death. There's nothing at all suspicious about this, according to the experts.
You guys have an arson task force out there, don't you? I ask. Can you refer it to the task force?
We have a countywide arson task force, yes, ma'am. But we don't refer every fire to the task force or they'd never have time to work on the real arsons. Now, do you have some information to give me about Joel Swanson that would make us believe that foul play was involved?
I don't know the first thing about Joel Swanson, I concede.
Well, then I think we're done, ma'am. I'm busy.
I know you are, Lieutenant, and I sure do appreciate your time. Can I ask for one more favor?
An audible sigh, loud enough to make sure I hear it.
What?
The bedroom, I say. What can you tell me about the layout of her bedroom? 11.
Lieutenant Ressler promises to send me that information on Joel Swanson's bedroom as soon as he can. That could mean 10 minutes, and it could mean never. I probably could have managed his ego a little better. It tends to facilitate cooperation. But I'm getting tired of hearing about firefighters who know a lot about suppressing fires but precious little about starting them, closing up files before a thorough investigation has taken place. If this were a warehouse with millions of dollars worth of damage, they'd dig through the ash and investigate the shit out of this. But a relatively small fire, with an obvious cause staring them in the face, is enough to make them shut down the investigation before it started. Needing a break from the computer and having no appetite for microwaved mac and cheese, I start scrubbing the kitchen floor. I'm kind of a neat freak, and it's what the real estate agent wants anyway. He was glad to hear that I was moving into the place after my mom moved to Florida and put it up for sale. It's easier to sell a house that someone is occupying. It was convenient for me, too, when I got suspended from the FBI. My condo in Georgetown was well beyond my financial capacity without a monthly salary. So, this is my life. I'm living in my mother's house in Urbana, Virginia, for now, while Mom heads for sunnier skies in Naples. Living at home, unemployed, and not in a relationship. Emmy at 35. When the kitchen floor is clean, I sit on my haunches and stretch my arms. I am tired in every way, physically and mentally. I got my hopes up with books, I have to admit. He has the FBI director's ear, and if anyone would believe in me, it would be books. But I can't blame him. He had every right to react the way he did. That's probably what bothers me the most. I mean, what did I expect? I broke up with him 3 months before the wedding. I freaked out, basically, and broke the heart of a wonderful man. Now, 2 years later, I come waltzing back into his life and expect him to say, "How high?" when I say jump. So now I'm back to a one-woman show, the Emily Jean Dockery Task Force, combing through data in the most amateurish way possible and calling local law enforcement all around the country, most of whom think I'm a lunatic. And they might be right. A knock at my door. A cold wave runs through me. I don't have many acquaintances here, much less friends, and it's past 8 o'clock now. I don't have a weapon either. I have my sponge and bucket. I could threaten to clean the guy to death.
Who is it?
I yell from the hallway. The voice that comes back is familiar. I exhale and open the door. Harrison Bookman is wearing a different shirt, but the same blue jeans as the other day. Under one arm, like school homework, is the stack of files I left him.
He never kills on Sundays,
he says. Never. Neither of us speaks for a long beat.
You better have good coffee,
he says. I do.
Sure. Now you say I do.
That's twice I've smiled this week. 12. We are walking, Books and I, along Pennsylvania Avenue Northwest, past where Daqua used to be. Our place, if any place was our place. Selecting dinner from the fresh catch of the day on the iced display in the dining room and sipping white wine, or sitting outside and looking over the fountains of the Navy Memorial. A bit frou-frou for both of our tastes, but it was our indulgence. It was our Friday night date. But things change. The restaurant's business lost steam, and so did our relationship. This is only happening because you're a man, I say to Books. Books appears to consider that seriously and gives a curt nod.
That's one possibility,
he concedes, his brow furrowed.
Or maybe...
He strokes his chin like he's Sherlock Holmes puzzling over a riddle.
Maybe it's because I'm considered to be sane by a few people in the building, and you aren't.
He snaps his fingers like, that sounds right to him. No, it's a gender thing. It's because I'm a woman.
A woman with sanity issues.
Books, I say. But then he stops cold just outside of FBI headquarters.
You wanted this, not me,
he snaps.
I'm trying to get you something you want. Why can't you just be happy about it without analyzing it to death?
Yowza. That's a little more hostility than I would have expected. He brushes past me. We give our names in the lobby. There was a time when each of us could flash a badge and walk on through. Now we're visitors, Books by design and me against my will.
Just a moment, says the woman at reception.
Books clasps his hands behind his back. It's always the little things that bring back the memories. He always held himself that way when he was on the job. Always the formality. Get him alone and he could have me in stitches, but to work with him, you'd think he was a typical humorless agent.
Joe Friday, just the facts, ma'am.
I used to make fun of him in happier days, clasping my hands like him, walking like a robot and saying,
yes, ma'am. No, sir. Remember, Emmy, this is my meeting.
Books turns and looks at me. I'll be good. Pinky promise.
I'm not a girl, so I don't know what the hell that means.
But you do have a pinky, don't you? He sighs.
It better mean that we do this my way.
That's what it means. I wouldn't have it any other way, Books. He lets out an exasperated grunt that tells me he doesn't believe me. He knows how high maintenance I can be.
You're the big man, I tell him.
I'm the little girl carrying your bag.
You're not carrying my bag.
But I will if you want. We get visitor badges from the receptionist. Our bags are thoroughly checked, and we head to the elevators.
You're full of vinegar today,
Books says. He's right. I'm hyped up, anxious, and this is how I'm compensating. This is the most important meeting I've ever had. So much is at stake. And here I am, cracking wise.
You understand that even getting this meeting is a favor,
Books says. I do. Books shoots me a look before we step into the elevator. He won't speak, not a word, as we rise. It's one of his rules, his super secret spy mindset. No discussing business in front of strangers. But I know what he wants to say. I strung those two words together again. I do. In my defense, I did break it off 3 months in advance. We got back the deposit on the banquet hall, and the invitations hadn't gone out yet.
I wonder if books would consider that consolation. I'm guessing not. We give our name to some woman, and she shows us down the hall to one of the big conference rooms used by FBI Director William Moriarty. I can see Books tense up as we approach the room. This is the first time he's returned since he handed in his papers, over the director's objection. The first time he's roamed these halls with the thin carpeting and cheap artwork and the air of intensity. The thrilling whiff of the chase, hunting bad guys and keeping the nation safe. This can't be easy for him. I've asked for a lot from him. Not that I deserve any courtesy from him whatsoever after what I did to him. Mental note, Books is good people. I mean, he not only got a meeting, he got one with the top dog. He managed to bypass my boss, the dick, who clearly would have shot it down if he had the chance. I'm glad he won't be in this meeting. The door opens. Standing at the end of a long table is Director Moriarty, flanked on his left by his chief of staff, Nancy Parmaggiore. And to his right, the Executive Assistant Director for the Criminal Cyber Response and Services Branch, also known as Julius Dickinson, also known as the Dick. Shit, I whisper, as Books gently shoves an elbow into me. 13. William Moriarty, former FBI agent, federal prosecutor, congressman from New York, and federal judge in Washington, D.C., now the director of the FBI for the last 3 years, lights up when he sees Books. Books worked under Moriarty during Moriarty's previous stint with the Bureau, and Moriarty didn't get where he is by forgetting people.
I took credit for a lot of this guy's good work, he tells his chief of staff and the Dick,
both of whom smile and nod with appreciation like good little soldiers.
Didn't want to let this one go. Now he's selling books.
The director takes a seat and motions for everyone else to do the same. Then he makes a point of checking his watch.
I have to brief the president at 3, so I only have about 10 minutes,
he says. 10 minutes? To talk about the worst serial killer in our nation?
Assistant Director Dickinson has briefed me on the particulars, he says. And I have to agree with him that if this is the work of one man, it is the most incredible story I've ever heard.
The Dick nods eagerly. After a moment, his eyes make their way over to mine. The dirty little bastard. But I promised Books I would behave. And anyway, the point is to get the Bureau to investigate whoever gets the credit. But for the record, fuck him.
Now,
says the director, raising a hand.
I don't know the details like Julius does, but from what he's told me, I agree with him on something else, too.
That he's a conniving, backstabbing, brown-nosing ass?
It's very, very premature to believe that this is one man's work, or that these are even crimes in the first place.
Moriarty looks over at the Dick.
Julius suggests that we take this slowly before we commit too many of our precious resources to this issue. Julius is recommending that we open a preliminary investigation.
Is that what Julius recommends after his careful review of the evidence? How great of Julius!
Books, do you want in on the Bureau's team?
Yes, Mr. Director,
says Books.
Sir, the Dick raises a hand. With Agent Bookman retired, we'd have to iron out some details for reinstate.
Then iron them out.
The director looks at the Dick.
You can iron them out, can't you, Julius?
Yes, sir.
Of course.
The director nods in Books' direction.
Maybe he'll have so much fun we'll get him back for good.
Books clears his throat.
Mr. Director, will I be running the team then?
Moriarty jabs a finger to his right.
Assistant Director Dickinson will run it and report to me.
You gotta be kidding, I say before I can stop myself. All eyes turn to me. I've just violated the one rule of behavior laid down by Books before we came in, but really, the Dick is going to run this operation? Are you freaking kidding me? Books puts a hand on my arm.
Very good, Mr. Director. But will I have a say in the staffing of the team?
Moriarty looks surprised, like he can't understand why something like that would require his attention.
I'm sure you and Julius can work that out.
Very good, sir, but specifically, Emmy Dockery here, one of your research analysts, the one who put together all of this.
Books stops talking because the director is no longer listening. The Dick has leaned in to whisper something to the director, and the chief of staff is now huddling with them as well. While his underlings are chatting in his ear, the director looks up at me. I try to look like a stable and composed research analyst, not someone whose head is about to spontaneously combust. Finally, Director Moriarty waves them both off.
Ms. Dockery?
Yes, sir, I say.
Give us the room, if you would.
Give them the room? What the heck does that mean? I look at Books.
He wants you to step outside so we can talk about you,
says Books. Oh. I get to my feet and don't even look down the table at the big shots, for fear that daggers will spring from my eyes and pin back their ears. Thank you, I say, not sure why I've chosen those words. I close the door behind me, so people more important than I am can decide my fate. 14. A receptionist, or some lackey, meets me when I step out of the conference room. Nobody's allowed to just wander around up here. And I find myself in a small waiting area reading a Time magazine story about how our nation is getting really fat. No shit. Just discovering that now, are we? Once I've been let in on the shocking revelation that the reason for childhood obesity is that kids are sitting around playing video games and eating lard-filled Happy Meals and sugar-coated, chemically-enriched sodas and snacks, Books appears and sits across from me. I raise my eyebrows with expectation. He smiles and shakes his head, then claps his hands.
Tomorrow at 5 o'clock sharp, we're meeting in Dickinson's office, and he's going to give us our marching orders,
he says.
And we're going to follow them, Emmy.
So that means I'm going to be a part of this team?
That's what it means. The director agreed, over Dickinson's objection, of course, that you can assist the team, under my supervision.
I don't like how any of that sounds.
I don't either, Emmy. I'm questioning whether I should be doing this at all.
I can see from his pained expression that he means it. He probably had to fight for me in there, and I should be grateful. I am, I guess. I just don't like being treated like someone who has to be babysat. This whole stupid, male-dominated place.
Smile, Emmy,
he says.
Because if you don't like this, I'll just go back to Alexandria and sell books. And without me, you're back on suspension.
You don't get to order me to smile, Books. He actually laughs, but not because he finds me humorous or because he's in a good mood. I know that laugh. It's a laugh of exasperation. His other emotions, frustration, anger, depleted.
You have a personal interest in this investigation,
he says.
No agent would ever be allowed on a team with a personal interest. No agent would ever be allowed to investigate her own sister's death.
I'm not an agent, I say, batting my eyes like a schoolgirl. I'm just a mere research analyst.
And lucky for you,
he replies,
because the only reason you get a pass is that, as a technical matter, you're merely assisting in the investigation. You get to be a part of the team.
He's right. I know he's right. I'm supposed to be happy right now. I throw my head back, swallow hard, very, very hard, and take a deep breath. You got this meeting with Moriarty, and it worked, I say. And you fought to have me be a part of this team. I appreciate all of that, Harrison. I do. Shit, I said I do again. His index finger waves at me, a tisk-tisk motion.
Don't call me Harrison. I came back because it's possible, that we have a serial killer on the warpath, and I don't like serial killers as a rule. And you're the reason we even know about him. If this person is real, if this is a real thing, then he's not like anybody I've ever seen.
And we're going to catch him, I add.
Yes, if he's real, we're going to catch him, and Julius Dickinson is going to take all the credit. And you're going to be okay with that.
I raise my hands in surrender. As long as we catch him, I say. Books eyes me carefully, then pushes himself out of his chair.
If he even exists,
he says. 15.
Graham Session, recording number 4, August 29th, 2012. Hello, class. Do you mind if I call you class? I assume you're listening to this because you want to learn. And when I say learn, I don't just mean learn about me, background, motivations, etc., but learn from me, too. Maybe not every one of you. Some of you just have plain old morbid curiosity, looking for a peek at a day in the life in the same way you slow your vehicle at the sight of an accident, hoping for a glimpse of a split forehead, gushing blood, or a limp body on a gurney, a dead hand dangling down. But at least some of you out there, I'm sure, want to know more than how I do it and why I do it. You want to know if you could do it too. Here's the good news. You can! And I'm going to show you how. I'm going to walk inside now. It looks like it might rain. I'll talk a little louder inside, and I hope you can hear me over the crowd noise, because this place is really starting to fill up. Just for your information, if you're wondering how I'm talking to you while I'm in a crowd of people, my audio recorder looks like a smartphone, so I just hold it up to my ear and talk into the end with the microphone as if I'm on the phone with some friend. As long as I do the necessary things to sell it, pause occasionally while my phantom person on the other end speaks, sprinkle in some interrupted sentences, occasionally throw in a, "What?" or "Can you hear me now?" or the like. Scrunch my face and put my hand over my ear and concentrate now and again. No one will doubt I'm on the phone. For example, here I am, threading my way through the crowd forming in this bar, and I'm not 3 feet away from a guy who looks pretty intense, muscle-bound with a tight haircut, his t-shirt 2 sizes too small, that kind of thing. And I know that I can say whatever it is I want to say about him, and he won't so much as bat an eye, because I'm speaking in a conversational tone with an electronic device against my ear. Here, I'll show you. I'd like to have a few minutes alone with this fine gentleman so I could stick an ice pick through his ear and keep pushing until I hear a crunch, and then I'd like to set his body on fire with some kerosene and a blowtorch. And you have no idea at all that I'm talking about you, do you, my friend? What's that? Can you hear me now? Is that better? Can you hear me okay? See? It's a piece of cake. And this is one of the points I want to make to you, that I'll keep returning to. Whatever it is that you're doing to further your goal, you have to sell it. I mean, sell it all the way from start to finish. Go all out, everything you have. It can be a big thing or a minor detail. Actually, it's usually the minor details that derail you when you have to be the most careful. So, for example, with me on the phone right now, when I'm done visiting with you, I could just drop the recorder posing as a phone into my pocket without doing the things you normally do when you end a call. Say goodbye and punch a button, or if a call is dropped, shout into the phone, then look perplexed or disgusted and shake your head. I could give up the ruse, in other words, and just stuff the recorder in my pocket. But what if someone is watching me for some reason? Or what if someone with a badge clipped to his jacket is watching the security video of this establishment later, looking for signs of something amiss? It's not very likely, I'll grant you, but what if that happened? Then they'd see me walking through the bar, appearing to talk on the phone, but then ultimately just slipping it into my pocket. They'd know I was engaged
in deception. I would stand out to them. And standing out to people is not what you want to do. It is, pay attention now, the very last thing you want to do. So, I'll make sure, whenever I pick up this recorder to speak to you in any place where anybody could possibly see me, that I say, "Hello? Hey, how's it going?" or some such salutation. And when I'm done with my session with you, it will be, "Talk to you later, see ya, whatever." And then I'll touch a button to indicate hanging up. Just so you understand, so I don't confuse you. This matters, because I expect that the police might, just might, be reviewing the video footage from this bar tonight when they learn that this was the last place that Curtis Valentine was seen alive. That's him over there in the corner, the guy with the ponytail and some extra weight in his midsection, the black shirt and blue jeans, his head down in a glass of foamy beer, awkwardly shifting his weight from one side to the other. He runs a website maintenance business out of his home called Picture Perfect Designs. I learned that from Facebook. He seems like a nice enough guy. I learned that from talking to him on the phone yesterday when I set up this appointment, meeting for a beer at a local pub. Okay, he sees me now. We've never met in person, but he's guessing I'm his appointment, the way I'm looking around for somebody. "Curtis, hey, how are you? Nice to meet you in person. Hey, one second, let me finish up this call." "Okay, class, I gotta run now. Talk soon. Bye." "Sorry, Curtis. It's great to finally meet you in person." End.